This is the 333rd Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo coming up. Now is your last chance to change stations to avoid my diatribe. There's a CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. People who've heard my shows ask me whether I suffered from depression. No, I certainly do not. I'm not a sufferer. I'm merely a carrier like Typhoid Mary. I personally have nothing to be depressed about. I have a good marriage of many years, a comfortable home, reasonable health, a decent retirement income, some good friends, harmless in-laws, and two pleasantly stupid dogs. Beside that, I no longer work for idiots, and I have more than one radio station allowing me to vent my spleen weekly. Perhaps most satisfyingly, I'm old enough that I will likely die before the fruit of my generation's greed and stupidity become ripe, crippling society. We, who grew to maturity after World War II, lived in uniquely favorable times. Our education was subsidized, while most of us had families able to live well with the income of a single breadwinner, if you can imagine that. We lived under threat of the bomb, but we knew that hiding under a desk could save us. When we graduated from high school, we knew there were jobs out there with a decent income, job security, and a pension after we put in our time. Those who went on to college and university were offered good positions from which to pick. If we suffered reverses, there was a social safety net to help us through rough times. We used the Earth's resources recklessly without giving thought to their limits, nor the permanent damage we were doing to the ecosystem. We drove massive, inefficient cars and allowed our living spaces to grow to ridiculous proportions. We were fed promises of future pristine domed cities with flying cars, 2-hour, 4-day work weeks, and jobs for all who cared to work. When I look back, I'm amazed that we swallowed that bullshit. But bullshit was the name of the game, as we overlooked the waste of the Cold War and the exploitation of the Third World, feeding our insatiable greed. Chickens are coming home to roost, and you, my young friends, will be the ones who have to feed them and live with their droppings. Lots of luck. If you think I'm negative, try the following from Martin Luther. Quote, "We have altogether a confounded, corrupt, and poisoned nature, both in body and soul. Throughout the whole of man is nothing that is good." Wow. As Woody Allen once said, "I feel much better since I gave up hope." It's iPod time in Canada. Or rent a movie, or read a book. Whatever you do for entertainment, avoid television and radio, except, of course, community radio. From now until March, it will be Olympics, 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 punctuated, of course, by breathless news of the swine flu pandemic. Over the next weeks, there'll be exciting press releases on progress of the world's most expensive butane lighter and its clones as they wend their zigzag way back and forth across Canada. Talk about a non-event, hyped to the rafters. As for me, I'll ignore the whole performance, except as runners, waddlers, and wheelers make their way through Prince George. Weather permitting, I hope to be among the many local folk, mooning them in their silly candle. When Hitler fabricated the torch tradition, did he have any idea that his legacy would be maintained so assiduously by his enemies? Our federal minister of state for sport had the following comments regarding the torch. Quote, "Our time is here. Our time has begun. When that torch exploded into flame, it was like, wow, this is it." Gee, Mr. Minister, I mean, you know, like it was awesome. You know, like we can be really proud of, you know, the prowess of our country. I mean, like, wow, eh? What could make a country greater, you know, like having 12,000 citizens trot all over the countryside with a tin and plastic fire stick accompanied by an army of politicians, security men, and assorted hangers-on, burning gasoline and polluting the air, and all at our expense. 50 years ago today, I was an American soldier stationed in the Panama Canal Zone, stuck with temporary duty as a prison chaser. That involved supervising a couple of soldiers serving time in the base stockade for some minor infractions of the rules. To prevent the escape of these desperate, dangerous criminals serving time for insulting an officer or some petty theft, I was armed with a 12-gauge riot shotgun loaded with double-aught buck. During my time, I saw what this load could do to a target, so I carried the shells in my pocket. The 3rd of November was Panama Independence Day, a day of frustration for citizens of that country whose land was divided in two by a 16-kilometer-wide American-occupied canal zone. The only route between Panama City and Colón, their two major cities, was by the leave of foreign soldiers. Imagine Canadians' frustration if Manitoba were occupied and we hadn't freed movement across our country. On this Independence Day, celebrating the time when Americans engineered the breakaway of the province of Panama from Colombia, thousands of Panamanians rallied between Panama City, Panama, and Balboa Canal Zone. Rioting broke out and our infantry troops were sent to seal the border. My shotgun was commandeered, and I was given a little carbine for my protection from two convicts with whom I had become quite familiar and comfortable. Rumors were rampant, but as usual, we common soldiers were told nothing about events transpiring a few short kilometers from us. The next week's Latin American edition of Time magazine carried a full-page article on the uprising, in which it emphasized the professionalism and restraint shown by American soldiers in constraining violent masses of rioters. However, fellow soldiers who had been on the front lines told me of seeing our troops firing M1 rifles and shotguns directly into the masses. There were definitely Panamanians killed and wounded. Bodies and the wounded were disappeared, while the whole fiasco went down the memory hole. I've never seen reference to this event in any history. Maybe it has a place of prominence in Panama, but it seems to be ignored in North America. In 1770, the so-called Boston Massacre resulted in 5 deaths. Everyone who has heard of this massacre, but the Panama City Massacre of 1959, has drawn little ink. Democracy in Canada has slid into severe crisis. It really hadn't too far to slide, as democracy in the framework was flawed from its inception. The very design of government was skewed to give power to wealth while deterring the popular will. In common with most administrations around the world, there's an ongoing assumption that the whims of Canadian hoi polloi are not to be trusted. There's certainly no encouragement for those believing in popular democracy when we see our public distracted by pure bullshit like balloon boy nonsense, while we ignore the overwhelming crisis of the century, whether humanity will exterminate itself through recklessly burning fossil fuels. For Canada to nurture a real democracy, our party system would have to be thoroughly revamped. For a start, Harper should be exiled back to the Citizens Coalition, and Ignatieff returned to Harvard. Both major parties need leaders unafraid to address serious issues. This business of having two large parties, neither of which digs deeper than superficial hair-splitting and personal attacks, is getting us nowhere. I'd love to witness debates between intelligent leaders discussing serious issues of the day, which now slide under the public radar. What a difference that would make. Imagine opening a discussion of the real challenges facing Canada. Let the debate begin over the direction of our military. Do we pour resources into defending our territory or engaging in overseas adventures? If the former, what level of materiel and personnel is appropriate? If the latter, under what conditions and at whose direction? Does Canada's participation in NATO and NORAD make any sense 20 years after the collapse of communism? What should we do about our participation in the Afghan War? What should be our approach to crime? Is our aim to punish, rehabilitate, or isolate convicts? How could we improve the system so that justice is swift, fair, and appropriate? How can we prevent either prosecution or defense from dragging proceedings on for years? Can we assure that Canadians cannot buy all the justice they can afford? Has NAFTA outlived its usefulness? Is there a way to reindustrialize Canada, and would that involve bringing back tariffs on goods and services? What's our responsibility to those who cannot fit into a system of rewards based on participation in the economy? Should there be a minimum standard of living? Should we work to eliminate poverty and homelessness? Should we collectively seek to reduce the depths of poverty and the peaks of extreme wealth? Should income taxes be flat or progressive? Should there be a wealth tax to recapture some of the huge wealth accumulated by families? These and many other problems should be debated seriously by Canadians. But a necessary precondition for any discussion is a freely competing communications media. We'd have to break up media monopolies in print and broadcasting so that none could hijack information sources the way CanWest has the media in Vancouver. As long as balloon boy stories and such trash dominate public attention, we cannot expect any real control over our collective fate, leaving decisions to corporate elites to run our lives for us. What are we to make of the popular enthusiasm for so-called extreme fighting? This is not a sport, as it has no rules. It is staged street brawling. Promoters can make big bucks by arranging fights and selling rights on pay-per-view television. These are folks who would sell their grandmothers for a buck, and I understand them. What I fail to understand is the audiences who will exchange good money for the right to view brutality. This extreme fighting should be a natural regrowth, could be a natural result of increasing realism in movies and television. Go back to movies of a half century ago and see how death and fighting were portrayed. When one was shot, he fell dead. In a staged fight, it was common for the good guy to fight fairly and do so without losing his hat. Now fights are graphic and carry on with gory detail. It's as though producers try to outdo each other in portrayal of violence. What happens when sex and violence reach their limits? We then get torture and rape and extreme fighting. We become inured to the shock of seeing and hearing of them. When was the Canadian outrage at learning that our soldiers have knowingly turned prisoners over to Afghan torturers? Was there sympathy for Tamil refugees fleeing violence in Sri Lanka? How much do we care about the homeless and hungry here in the province whose shameless leaders proclaim this is the best place on earth? Have we become a nation of self-centered, callous creeps bereft of any empathy? When it comes to the aforementioned Canadian complicity in torture of Afghans, Harper's regime has pulled out all the stops in abdicating any responsibility for or even acknowledging that torture took place. No way will Harper oversee the nailing of anyone to this in his government with responsibility, from the private soldier up to himself. It did not happen, and if it did, it was legal, and his office knew nothing. It looks like one of those cases where everyone at the bottom was just following orders, while no one above issued those orders. Everyone is clean. Our former Chief of Defense Staff, Rick Hillier, refuses to carry the can on this one. He swears that he reported his concerns that Afghan prisoners were being abused many times and directly to the Prime Minister's office. If prisoners were mistreated in violation of the Geneva Conventions, it was with the full knowledge and permission of the highest reaches of the Conservative government, and that means Harper. General Hillier said, quote, "The fact is, there's been an ongoing cover-up, an ongoing neglect of the duty to protect our soldiers. This government has been absolutely negligent and neglectful in protecting our forces from prosecution as war criminals." Unquote. Perhaps the day will come when Stephen Harper and his officials will join Henry Kissinger in being afraid to leave home for fear of arrest overseas and trial as war criminals. A recent tradition accompanying biennial Olympics has been the declaration of a temporary truce in active combat. Leaders of host nations are expected to make a stand at the United Nations General Assembly, pleading for a halt to violence in the spirit of peaceful international competition for which the Olympics were supposed to stand. This tradition has been a cynical exercise, and Canada has followed suit. Our motion this year called on all UN members to observe the Olympic truce, individually and collectively, during the 2010 Olympic Games and Paralympic Winter Games. Our government, of course, refuses to suspend its war against Afghanistan. John Furlong, the point man for VANOC, sees no contradiction here. He said, "I've always felt that Canada is fighting for peace." Bullshit. As the American protesters against the Vietnam War used to say, fighting for peace is like fornicating for chastity. Our leaders are unalloyed hypocrites. Good news, though. Our provincial government is flush with cash again. How else can one explain the revelation that Campbell's financial geniuses will lend $458 million to the BC Pavilion Corporation for replacement of the roof on BC Place Stadium? They haven't explained whether this Crown Corporation will repay this loan with enough interest to cover the cost of borrowing for the government. They haven't explained whether this $458 million is a firm price or an estimate subject to inflationary increases. This corporation claims that it can repay the loan by selling the name of the stadium and some of its neighboring real estate. Last year, the Premier's office estimated that sale and development of those lands could bring in $100 million, leaving a mere third of $1 billion to be covered by giving the stadium a corporate logo. You know of any companies with that kind of money rattling around in the kitty to drop on this kind of nominal investment? First of all, that projected $100 million is not found money. It would come from selling off land that belongs to the people of British Columbia. The imagined sale of BC Place's name for hundreds of millions of dollars is the result of Tinkerbell thinking. Might I be considered cynical if I foresaw the day when the bulk of this loan will be written off? Suppose the government chose to invest that $458 million in building houses for the homeless to be rented for a future flow of income. New homes at, say, $225,000 each would number 2,000. That's a lot of roofs for the price of one. It would generate income and put many more British Columbians to work than construction of one roof that will house no one. But these politicians must know what they're doing. Didn't we elect them for their fiscal probity? This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Recall that Donald Rumsfeld famously stated, "There are known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns." For this he was ridiculed, but when you analyze it, it makes sense. Any action we take has known consequences, ones that we can foresee but not predict, and the possibility of other results which can blindside us. Such it is in the case of the all-electric car. The known consequences are a decrease in direct petroleum use for transport, an increase in price of autos, and more electricity consumption. The known unknowns here are the technological advances necessary to produce batteries that will carry adequate charge, availability of exotic materials for those batteries, sources, and cost of upgrades to hydro production and distribution. Some unknown unknowns can be guessed at. For instance, with these batteries costing as much as $10,000 each, will there be a flourishing market for stolen ones? Estimates can be made of the amount by which generation and transmission of electricity must be increased, but it remains to be seen what cost will be in dollars and damage to the environment. California faces the advent of the electric car with more foresight than BC seems to. Their private electricity companies expect that new transformers and transmission lines will cost utilities billions of dollars over the next decade. Who will shoulder the costs? And those utilities have yet to figure out where the power on those lines will be generated. Are they looking north to Canada? Here in BC, we already have a looming power crisis, even without exports for electric automobiles. Campbell promotes private power producers as answers to filling the gap, but most of these involve harnessing falling water that is seasonal rather than year-round. Before any jurisdiction goes gung-ho into converting to electric cars, it had better have answers to how and where the power will come from and how it will be distributed and financed. According to information received by the BC Civil Liberties Association, former Vancouver Mayor Larry Campbell signed a secret agreement with the International Olympic Committee in 2003. This agreement, called a host city contract, guaranteed that spectators and international media will be separated from any propaganda from protesters. This is the root of new legislation allowing officials to enter private homes to remove offending signage. It also explains the sudden concern of our provincial government for the homeless in Vancouver's east side. Gordon Campbell will be providing housing for these unfortunates, at least for the duration of the party. Too bad this concern did not surface decades ago, and too bad it will evaporate when the last tourist leaves town. Warren Buffett spoke out on the unfairness of taxes. He said that he's been taxed too little, with his effective rate being lower than that of his lowest paid staff. He joined an international movement which is small but remarkable. In Germany, wealthy citizens have launched a petition to their government requesting a restoration of the former wealth tax of 5%. They recognize their society is in deep financial trouble and would remove unneeded money from the very rich and apply it to their deficit. In the United States, there's an outfit called United for a Fair Economy seeking higher taxes. I agree that it's time for those with more than we need to contribute to the desperate among us. Contributions to charity are not enough. We should work to reduce the obscene highs and lows of income and wealth. Does this sound like a socialist ideal? Well, yes and no. It could be seen as a safety valve that would save capitalism from its enemies. Didn't proponents of unrestricted free enterprise claim that their so-called rising tide of wealth would lift all boats? Weren't we all to become wealthy? One can say that their rising tide did indeed lift all boats, but they neglected to mention that not everyone has a boat, and those bereft of even a canoe would drown. While financial adherents to Islam receive a lot of bad press these days, they're not alone in carrying doctrine to ridiculous lengths. Ultra-Orthodox Jews have their own brand of edicts, not unlike Muslim fatwas. One rule takes the commandment that they should keep the Sabbath to extremes. Since their God loafed on the seventh day, after the heavy lifting of creating a six-day do-it-yourself job on the universe, so should his faithful followers. They've taken this concept of avoiding work very literally. They're not allowed to ride in elevators if it involves the arduous labor of pushing buttons. Israeli high-rises with ultra-Orthodox tenants have installed Sabbath elevators which stop at every floor, thus eliminating the affront to the Almighty resulting from exercising fingers. There are more fanatical adherents who refuse to even use these elevators as their weight increases the consumption of electricity, an effect that would not pass the note of God. So they are reduced to lugging groceries and such upstairs, but wait, isn't climbing stairs work? Maybe the Sabbath is a good time for the faithful to stay in bed and without any hanky-panky that could break a sweat. But the elevator ruling isn't the end of it. Last month, the same religious scholar who announced the elevator prohibition declared that Crocs footwear was not to be worn on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, as they were deemed too comfortable. I have trouble imagining such a petty deity. Maybe he, she, it should have a hobby that doesn't involve micromanaging our small planet and its inhabitants. Sometimes you have to rise above your principles and do what you think is right. It's an expression attributed to that prolific Greek philosopher, Anonymous. He also recognized that politicians must occasionally bypass the will of the know-nothing majority and do what is reasonable. Such is the case of one Arnold Schwarzenegger, one-time movie star and governor of the Golden State of California. His state faces a fiscal mess, appearing intractable. Costs of public services have risen while revenues have plummeted. Legislation resulting from a past referendum prohibits the state from raising taxes, and the government's not allowed to run a deficit. In the past year, 100,000 teachers, healthcare workers, cops, firefighters, and other public servants have been fired, with more to go unless the state can right its finances. Only drastic, imaginative actions will save California from bankruptcy. The state has been forced to consider taxing and regulating a lucrative major industry which has remained underground for decades. That is, the growing and distribution of marijuana. Polls show 56% of Californians want to see the ban lifted that has been on the books for 96 years. It's been amply demonstrated that the trade will not be stopped by legal repression, and this has merely forced the business into the hands of the underworld. It's been estimated that legislation and taxation could bring in $1.4 billion while saving hundreds of millions in policing and prison costs. The big unknown is how the federal government will react, as marijuana possession is still a federal crime. Obama has stopped federal raids on medical marijuana distribution when allowed by individual states, so it might just turn a blind eye to legalization in California. Other states would be forced to back off persecution of users and peddlers of pot if citizens could buy the drug openly in California. This whole structure of prohibition could collapse like the Berlin Wall. This would have a collateral benefit in Canada, as smuggling of pot from here has become unprofitable. The trade in guns coming north in exchange would decrease, making our streets safer. I do hope that California's financial problems continue so they're forced to rise above their principles and do what they think is right. Which is more important, public health or the shipping industry? No prizes for correct answers on this one. The American so-called Environmental Protection Agency has bowed to ship owners of the Great Lakes by rescinding an order that they use low-sulfur fuel. They may continue to use highly polluting bunker fuel containing 17,000 parts per million of sulfur. A previous order would have forced shippers to use cleaner fuel containing 1,000 parts per million. The Harper regime appealed to the EPA to rescind the order as it would have caused economic hardship. Emissions of sulfur compounds cause health problems and deaths on both sides of the Great Lakes, but profits of shipping companies trump the well-being of our citizens. Does Paul Martin still own the Canada Steamship Lines? If so, he will celebrate the triumph of finance over health. Few Canadian citizens will join him. What is the value of Canadian citizenship? There are many who can testify. For one, there's the Canadian woman stranded in Kenya when the local government seized and destroyed her passport, claiming she was an imposter. Local Canadian consular officials refused to help her until DNA tests proved her identity. Eskwan Abdelrazik, Canadian citizen, stranded in Sudan as Harper's regime pulled all the strings available to prevent his return to his family. But we haven't the price tag for those two cases. Finally, we have a figure for efforts to exclude another Canadian, Omar Khadr. As of July, Canada's Justice Ministry reported that it had spent $1,335,342.37 to keep Omar in Guantanamo's concentration camp. In spite of his being a Canadian citizen, a youth at the time of his supposed offense, and his lawyers having made the case that accusations against him rest on dubious grounds, this government refuses to allow his repatriation. The reason? He comes from a family of accused terrorists. Americans want to convict Omar through a military kangaroo trial. The whole case and proceedings are of such dubious strength and legality that they would love to dump Omar back into Canada, but Harper refused. We already have a system of security certificates by which politicians can incarcerate people indefinitely without trial. Now we have a government which shows a stark willingness to exclude our own citizens whom they disfavor. Perhaps, just perhaps, one day we will have an administration which will take its own passports more seriously than just another piece of identification. I had a brush with Scientology while in California. A good and old friend had gotten wrapped up in this cult when I first went west and stayed with him in his live-in. It was remarkable how this supposed religion took hold of adherents. I wouldn't buy this system of beliefs any more than I did any other, and I had the honor of being declared a suppressive person or one to be shunned by Scientologists. My friend dropped out of the system some time later, and his partner, God bless her, went her own way. The United States government continues to tolerate Scientology under its obsessive protection of any group calling itself a religion and wrapping itself in constitutional protections. Germany is not so tolerant of lunacy and keeps the faith under surveillance. Belgium is investigating it for blackmail. And in France, Scientology has been convicted of fraud and extorting money from adherents. As with so many religions, Scientology preys on the insecure. It offers a sense of community and promises of personal development. Once entangled, the recruit is sold books and sessions that are supposed to clear their minds of deep-seated traumas preventing development. There are always higher states to be achieved, for a fee. The ultimate goal is to become clear of engrams in the brain. Once clear, the candidate is supposed to be capable of amazing feats, although there seem to be no examples to offer. When you compare Scientology to other faiths, the differences are only in degree. Most others promise their benefits after death if adherents will only follow ancient arcane rules and, of course, support a hierarchy of layabouts wearing strange costumes in the manner to which they become accustomed. Thus endeth the 333rd Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia.